We got your front, too, but I don't mean that in an inappropriate way at all. It's 6:14, Tommy Tucker, WWL, hot human today, chance for showers as always. And Todd Bell joins us, professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University, to talk about Elon Musk and his plans, he says, to create a third party. How you doing, Professor?
Doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I always thought that a third party, I didn't know if it was ever viable or not, but then I got to thinking about Elon Musk, and I got to thinking about, well, maybe it might be. Then I got to thinking about, well, I don't know if I want him starting a third party. I don't know where you want to start with this. First of all, what is his citizenship status? I'm trying to figure out. He's an American citizen or he's not?
He is an American citizen, but Elon Musk is not able to run for president because he was born in South Africa. So he would not be a candidate for president under their new party.
So when it comes to starting a party or whatever, does citizenship have anything to do with any of that at all?
Not really. No, what you have to do when you're starting a party is you need to get registered in the different states and get on the ballot. And the way you do that is each state actually has different regulations. Some states it's easier than others, but it usually requires you to go around and get signatures. Most political parties, if they reach a certain threshold at the last election, they're automatically on the ballot in the following election. But if you want to get on the ballot as a new party, you have to go around and get signatures so that your candidates can get recognized in the primary and general elections.
When we talk about third party, do we normally think presidential race? But would that be where the biggest opening would be for a third party, or would it be with Congress? Or tell me about that, Professor.
Interestingly not. It's a great question. And the history of third parties in the United States, until recently, we've had a couple third parties that actually replaced other parties. We had the Whig Party replace the Federalist Party back in the 1800s and such. But since we've had our modern system of elections of senators and members of the House, it's extremely difficult for third parties to win either in Congress or in the presidency. Now, they have had some success in the U.S. Senate. You've got Bernie Sanders, who ostensibly he's a Democrat, but calls himself an independent. He was never a Democrat until he ran for president in 2016. And Angus King from Maine, who is an independent. So they are ostensibly third-party candidates who have been able to win. We've had a couple others here and there in the House. But for the most part, third-party candidates don't win in the United States because we have structural impediments to their victory. And that includes compared to other democracies around the world, we have what's called the first-past-the-post system, also known as plurality elections. In most states where you don't need a majority, you just need to get the most votes. It can be a plurality, less than 50%, but as long as you get the most, you get the seat. We also do not have multi-member districts at the House level. That would mean you would have 3 members from each district or 5 members from each district, which would give more opportunities to third parties. And we don't have what's called proportional representation, where you go to a place like Germany, where you see a lot of third parties having power. If you vote for the party and they get proportion of the legislature based upon the percentage they get in the election. We don't have that here. So all of this comes together to give a real advantage, not an exclusive win, but, a real advantage to the two-party system because it's difficult for a third party to surmount some of those obstacles. And, of course, those obstacles are very similar at the presidential level because, you're counting the votes with the Electoral College, which is, representatives and senators. So it's hard to win an actual state. The last time we had somebody win an actual state, I believe, was George Wallace back in the 1968 election, which was a very interesting election. So, not likely. Remember, Ross Perot got 19% of the votes back in 1992 and didn't get a single electoral vote. So it just goes to show you, even though you can run up some popularity, it's extremely difficult to translate that into electoral success.
So when it comes to U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senate, there are rules that transcend states. Every state has the same rules because it's a federal election in terms of who can qualify.
Right.
Take me through that.
Yeah, in the House and the Senate right now, there's a, what really gives rise to the one party, I'm sorry, the two-party system, is that you have single-member districts and no proportional representation. Now, it is true that you have two senators per state, but they almost never run at the same time, unless there's a vacancy. So you usually have just one that you're choosing, which means it's probably going to be a Republican or a Democrat. For the for a third party to try to surmount both of the major parties is exceptionally difficult.
Let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about money and where that figures into this. I don't think Ross Perot, and I might be wrong, I don't think Ross Perot had Elon Musk money, and Elon likes to, you know, have a lot of attention toward him, and I guess we all do, so I'm not criticizing him for that, but I don't know how serious he is about this and what exactly he would be standing for. And also, Professor, when we come back, I want to talk about the, I guess, the strategery involved in this, where can you do it with baby steps, where maybe you just win a key Senate seat there or a key House win there, and then before you know it, the majority's not what it once was, and then you start developing a little bit of momentum, and before you know it, you got a full-fledged third party. Maybe I'm just dreaming, but I'm wondering. 620 traffic now. Oh, by the way, I should tell you, we're talking to Todd Belt, a professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University, about Elon Musk creating a third party. Text me on the Oakmont Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Please, no texting and driving. But let me know what you think about that. Would you support an Elon Musk third party? And what would you like to see a third party address? Traffic now, WWL. It is 625. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Professor Todd Belt. He's a professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University, about Elon Musk being a maybe starting a third party. And somebody, a couple of texts that are coming in. Elon needs to go back to tending his own business. He was doing good. Other than that, time to leave the government issues to the people that have the expertise. I think some people would say maybe it's time for people that don't have the expertise. A third viable party would be great, but as with the other two clubs, it all depends on the candidate. For me, somebody else says, is an Elon Musk third party more about taking some power from Trump or actually winning? I support either. So, Professor Belt, when it comes to baby steps and making inroads, is there any way, and you know, you talk about a path to victory, I'm thinking maybe if he targets one race here, one race there, the majorities are so thin in the Senate or the House, either way, relatively speaking, that maybe if he just picks off a seat here or there, then before you know it, he gets some momentum, he's got something going. And I got to piggyback that question with money. Because it's going to take a lot of money, a lot of money. Thoughts on all of that?
Right. Okay, first, let me start with the money part. Obviously, Elon Musk is the wealthiest man in the world, and he spent $25 million in a Supreme Court race, a state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, and came up short, and he was a little bit missed by that, said he was going to exit politics, but that was all before the big beautiful bill was passed.
Wait, let me jump in. Let me jump in for a second there. Was it because he didn't spend enough, or he just had a flawed candidate, or why did he lose?
Yeah, I think it was because the candidate was not great, and Wisconsinites. It was really about overturning an old abortion law, and abortion is a pretty popular policy. So I don't think it was going to work there. But in terms of trying to get the party organized, remember I was talking about how many signatures you need to get. If we look at the way Ron DeSantis ran his campaign in Iowa in 2024, he decided to go with a very money-heavy campaign where instead of using volunteers, he was going to be hiring people to, you know, work for the campaign. And there's a difference when you have volunteers versus you have paid people, because the paid people don't have the real fire in the belly. They're not quite as energetic about the candidate and the party and want to do the type of work that it takes and work the hours that it takes to get on the ballot. So you'd have to spend a lot more money than you would initially imagine, because you're not going to get as effective volunteers to work on that. But in terms of trying to pick away a couple seats, it is true you could spoil an election. This is what third parties have generally done in the United States, is take votes away from one of the two major parties. But what usually happens after that is the two parties look and see, okay, there is a group of voters that are interested in the policies of this third party, whatever they are, let's make those our part of our party's platform and get those voters back. And usually they have been able to do that. For Republicans, after the Reform Party in 1992 with Ross Perot, they were able to make balancing the budget really part of what they wanted to do, and they were able to recoup some of those voters. So the parties adjust, so it's difficult to build momentum, and the fact that we have two-year election cycles mean you have to string that momentum out for a longer period of time, so it's difficult to
get. Well, what Americans, do Americans embrace the idea of a third party? What do polls show? Is it about specific issues, or do they like it in theory, but not in practice?
In theory, but not in practice, yes. When we, early on in the election, you might remember back in early 2024, a lot of people were interested in a third-party alternative. That's why we had RFK running, and other people were going to try to create a unity ticket where you'd have one Republican and one Democrat. And there was a lot of support in the polls, but when it comes right down to it, when you get down to an election day, the polling for third parties really evaporates because people get worried. They don't want their vote to get canceled out. They don't want to vote for a losing candidate. And we know that in politics, it's this fear and anxiety that's caused by wasting your vote is actually more more influential than the attractiveness of a third party.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. Hope you have a great weekend. I'm going to give you tomorrow off already, just like that. Todd Belt, Professor Director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University. Thursday morning, that means we talk to Mike Strain. We come back, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. 6:43, 17 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Thursday morning around these parts. That means it's time to talk to our friend Mike Strain, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, and a well-respected veterinarian on the North Shore. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. How are you, Tommy?
I'm well. I got to ask you, I heard you do something on a commercial that just surprised the heck out of me, and it was about dogs getting sunburned. Did I hear that right?
Well, they can get sunburned, but the heat stress can really get them quickly, especially right now. You know, if you take a dog and put him in the back of a white pickup truck and you be driving through the field, they can still have heat stress and heat stroke, mm-hmm. and they can get burned from the sun. So especially if they're light-skinned, pale-skinned, you know, with white hair. Mm-hmm. And, of course, oftentimes in the summer, a lot of people will shave their dogs. The long-haired dogs can get shaved, and that can expose them to the sun. And so just be careful with that. But the heat stroke, heat stress is a much bigger problem. Do not leave your animal in the car, you know, ever. Do not just run in and leave the animal, or you, of course, little children either, but leave that dog in the car because they will get hot very, very, very quickly. A lot of dogs, especially indoor dogs, they're not used to the heat at all. And if they are out on the porch, you need to have, cool water, shade, and preferably a fan.
I got a text the other day asking me to ask you, and I presume they're listening now, Mike, about this. You talked about muddy gums or something, or some indication when the dog is hot.
Yeah, muddy.
Tell me about
it. In other words, when you look at the gums, that's a medical term that we use. They will look a little dark. They will look will not look uniform. So you think about muddy looking water, and then you look at the gums, instead of being nice and pink, they will be darker. They will be dark red. And you can obviously tell that you have a problem. It's one of the things that we do in the field. You can rapidly assess a patient, whether it's a dog or a horse or whatever, just looking at the gums. The other thing that we do is called a Blanch test, where we, use your thumb and you press against the gum and see how quickly it refills. Mm-hmm. And it should refill like in, a second or 1.5 seconds. You get out there to 3 seconds, you have serious cardiovascular problems.
Like they do with humans, almost with the nails, kind of like I
said. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, same thing. That's exactly right.
I know some stuff,
but now's the time to stay cool.
I know some stuff, don't I?
Yes, you do.
Well,
yes, you do.
Not much, a little bit, but a little bit.
I was headed to Dallas to meet with the EPA today, but my flight has now been canceled. And so, yes.
What did you do to make that happen?
Well, I guess I slept too hard, but, but we had this set up. We're meeting with a team, our corresponding team in Dallas. For the EPA, the Department of Ag and Forestry, we are the, you know, the arm of the EPA dealing with all restricted use chemicals mm-hmm. in the state. And it's through a memorandum of understanding between the Environmental Protection Agency and I in person of the commissioner. And so if you think about the termite spray, if you think about what's being sprayed for mosquitoes, if you think about any type of herbicide, pesticide, fungicide, anything, we work closely with the EPA. And so, you know, we have regular meetings, and we have the new regional administrator, Scott Mason, there in Dallas. He's a wonderful guy to work with. And so we go there, and we go through all the issues from the waters of the U.S., and we're talking about chemicals, compliance issues, air updates on, you know, on emissions. And, of course, we will be also bringing over discussion about trying to expedite the approval of the baits for the feral swine. That is kind of in limbo, and it went from taking 18 months and a few hundred thousand dollars to 8 years and $8 million, and we got to get that back on track. And so, you know, with all the things that we work on, including one, drone usage and uniformity and labeling, so a good discussion, but the rebook and the flight would get me there after the meeting, so that's not going to work. No. So we're going to be doing it virtual today. So
there you go.
We have a setup for that. But you know what? Virtual is 90%, but there in person is 100%. And for our, you know, our federal counterparts and all of the alphabet agencies that we work with, you know, I really believe in those personal relationships, especially when, you know, things go sideways on whatever issue it might be. That personal relationship straightens things out.
What is the problem with the swine thing, with the feral swine? Because I thought this was pretty benign, but it was a great way to eliminate or at least to keep these things from breeding. Tell me about what the EPA's problem is.
Well, the EPA said that the toxicant used, which is sodium nitrite. Now, sodium nitrite, if you had bacon and with your breakfast this morning, you had some sodium nitrite. It's been around since, you know, pre-Roman times, and it's used universally. But they said since you're going to use it in a manner to which would result in toxicity, then you've got to do complete studies like it's a new compound. And I totally disagree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably been more research done and published and known about sodium nitrate than anything else. And LSU developed a system where they would literally wrap this stuff in a capsule of, and I think it's more like pogey bait, and only the feral swine would eat it. So you would take it, actually bury it in the ground, and they would dig it up and eat it. And then it would, you know, it would kill the pigs, but not other species. It wouldn't affect bear, or there wouldn't be secondary problems like you would have with other toxicants or warfarin. And we were going along well, and then they told LSU, said, "Look, it's going to cost you, you know, $600,000-$800,000 in fees to register this, unless you went through the State Department of Agriculture. In that case, it would be no cost." And so we were well on our way to getting this product approved, developed by LSU, with 12-plus years of research. And then they came back and said, "No, you got to start over again and go through this whole process." And that's one of the things we're going to push, to look, this is ridiculous. We need this product. Those feral swine cost hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. The last call I had last night, 8 o'clock last night, friend called me, said these feral swine have destroyed my fields. And they are overpopulating. Now we estimate we have as many as 750,000 feral swine in the state. And we've got to get a handle on it, because they cause hundreds of millions of dollars of damage and carry disease and are a threat. They are a threat, little children, et cetera. I mean, they're dangerous out there, and we've got to do something about them.
So, Mike, when it comes to this stuff, the sodium nitrate or whatever it is, when the pig eats it, it dies. If something eats the pig, there's no danger to whatever eats the pig, is it?
Generally, no, because you won't get enough concentration of the sodium nitrite from eating the pig. And so what we've done with other things is that they've added a dye to the product, and so that if for some reason you would slaughter a wild pig, but you would never eat a wild pig that was sick. You never eat anything that's sick, but you would see a blue discoloration, a blue stain in the flesh. So that's part of that. But what it does is that the pig literally goes to sleep. It's just, they just go to sleep is what happens, and they just don't wake up. And so we're careful that there's no secondary kills. And the thing of it is, though, if that pig is up and running, there's no toxic dose in them, and you would not slaughter a pig that you found dead or dying, you know, at all.
Right. I meant more along the lines of like nature, you know. I don't know if you got a pig that drops dead somewhere.
No,
goes
you're
to
not
sleep.
Gonna get that. We're very careful with that. You would not get a secondary dose from consuming the flesh that would be high enough to be lethal, you know, because you're thinking of buzzards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, and other creatures that are that would eat, you know, would eat that flesh. So that no, it would not affect them, and that's one of the big deals in developing these toxicants. We're still hopeful that the USDA will actually continue its research on an anti-fertility vaccine, and that they've been working on that diligently, that could be delivered via a cookie bait. And that's not science fiction. We vaccinate wild animals for rabies with cookies that have little capsules. So when they eat the cookie, that the vaccine actually is freeze-dried. It becomes activated and goes through their tonsils and vaccinates them for rabies. And that was developed by Rome Mario, and it's used in the United States and across the world. We can develop the same thing for pigs. Then, you know, we can distribute. And you can distribute that, you know, using an aircraft or other vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And get, you know, and make them non-fertile, because one female can result in over 300 pigs in 3 years.
That's the approach you're taking with that screw worm, right?
Oh, now screw worms, another issue. You saw last night that Secretary Rollins has now suspended the importation of Mexican livestock into the United States. That happened yesterday because the screw worm has again jumped its containment by the Isthmus of Panama. And if you look on the map, that's a small area,
mm-hmm.
and we're very concerned about it moving through Mexico and getting into the United States. And so we are spending dollars. We, you know, we've sent dollars to Mexico to help them to breed more sterile flies, and those sterile flies would then mate with the screwworm flies and stop, you know, the progeny. But it's not enough. And so they are building a $300 million facility in Lower Texas to gear up for screwworm sterile flies in case it continues to march towards the border. We have to get a handle on this. And again, because what you've already seen it impacting beef prices already, but it could be the damage could be in the hundreds of billions. And the thing about this particular pest, it will attack and make sick and kill normal, healthy animals. That's the big deal about this screw worm. And we are gearing up for battle. We're gonna, you know, our goal is to keep it down there at the Isthmus of Panama, because it's a tiny area, much less trying to defend it across the entire U.S.-Mexican border. And so we are gearing up. There are ways that we can treat our cattle and our livestock, you know, but it's very costly. But if it gets here, it's estimated it could destroy up to 80% of the wild deer population and other native species. And so we've got to do everything it takes to stop this invasive pest from getting here.
Real quick, scale of 1 to 10, where are you worried at on that screw worm thing?
I'm at a 6 right now,
okay.
Tell you the truth.
Right.
I am concerned because it is jumping containment in a narrow area. And if it gets up into Mexico and spreads out and starts, you know, the thing about an invasive species is that it takes over the native species and becomes dominant. And it's very difficult to eliminate. And so the best method to fight this is with the sterile flies, not spraying insecticides.
Thank you,
and
Mike.
Then, so, but yeah, yep.
Got you. We're out
all
of time. Right. So, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next Thursday. Very valuable information. As always, 6:54, 6 till 7. Traffic now, WWL.